From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. Walter Isaacson has long been fascinated with innovators and great thinkers, geniuses. He's written biographies of Steve Jobs, Albert Einstein, Benjamin Franklin. His latest takes him to the life of Leonardo da Vinci, the Renaissance man who painted the Mona Lisa, the Last Supper, designed flying machines, and endlessly studied the human anatomy. He had a boundless curiosity that, says Isaacson, may make him the most creative genius in history. This hour, On Point, the genius of Leonardo da Vinci. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. What's your question about Leonardo, about his work, his art, his genius? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from New York is Walter Isaacson, president and CEO of the Aspen Institute, a D.C.-based think tank, at least for a couple more months, I see, stepping down soon. His biographies include Steve Jobs, Einstein, His Life and Universe, Benjamin Franklin, and American Life. His latest is Leonardo da Vinci. You can find an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Walter Isaacson, welcome back to On Point.
Thank you, Tom. It's good to be back with you.
It's wonderful to have you. What sent you tumbling back in time? We think of Steve Jobs and Einstein, even Franklin, but now we're all the way back here in the 14 and 1500s. What sent you back to Leonardo?
All the people I've written about, you know, Ben Franklin, all the way to Steve Jobs, they weren't just smart because, as you know from your show, you know, smart people are a dime a dozen and they don't usually amount to much. They were creative. You know, they were able to make imaginative leaps. And I wanted to say, what is creativity? How do you achieve it? And Leonardo seemed to be the ultimate example because, as you said, he had a boundless curiosity across all disciplines, and being able to see the patterns of nature across disciplines made him be able to sort of connect anatomy to art and science to math to design to engineering. And so I found that creativity something that really turned me on and something that we can learn from, because it was really driven just by curiosity and a deep, deep desire to observe things carefully.
We'll come to creativity and the learning that we can gain there from Leonardo. But take us across that range of interests of his. It is so stunning when you – this is a big book and beautifully illustrated. Yeah. But when I contemplate the range of intense, deep, passionate interests that he had – I mean, we know the Mona Lisa. We know the Last Supper and more, the Vitruvian Man, you know, arms mm-hmm. and legs spread wide in the famous circle and square. But just settle in for a moment, if you'd be good enough, Walter, and take us across the sort of range – of projects and interests. I mean, you've gone deep into his notebooks. What tumbles out, the range that tumbles out?
Well, the great thing about his notebooks is we've got more than 7,000 pages. You know, paper's a good technology. It lasts 500 years. And paper was a little bit expensive. So on any given page, you can see that question you just asked, the range of his interests. Like he would do an anatomy sketch of because he dissected human faces. And he'd show every muscle and every nerve that moves the lips and show whether the nerve's connected to the brain or the spinal cord. But on the top of one of those pages, he starts sketching a smile. And you see it evolve into the Mona Lisa smile. And so whether it was building a flying machine or trying to figure out why the sky was blue or doing one of his to-do lists, you know, which is describe the tongue of the woodpecker, figure out the size of the sun, you know, it was just wonderful going through his notebooks and seeing somebody who loved geology, loved painting, loved military affairs, engineering. He probably wanted to know everything you could possibly know about everything that could be known about the universe, including how we fit into it.
How much of it was in his head? Did he actually build the flying machines that he designed? I suppose they wouldn't have flown much, but did he build them? He has sketch after sketch after sketch
of
these gruesome war machines. Did he build those things?
Well, a lot of it was fantasy. And one thing I learned from looking at his notebooks is that his main job early in his career was as a theater producer. And we kind of forget that. And so like that famous helicopter, that aerial screw that people say, oh, he invented the helicopter. That thing never would have flown, but it was for a prop for one of the big pageants they were doing in Florence, and it brought the angels on down. And the cool thing about Leonardo is he let his imagination run wild when he was doing theater stuff, but then later he tried to apply it in the real world, and he actually tried to build flying machines. So you kind of see the fantasy moving into reality.
Give us a sense of this, the story of this young man. Boy, I mean, he's from this village, Vinci, near Florence. Who was he? What kind of family did he come from? How did he come up in such a way that does it help us explain or understand who he became?
Absolutely. He had the great good fortune to be born out of wedlock. That meant that he couldn't be a notary like his father, grandfather, and great-grandfather were, and he would have been a terrible notary. I mean, he just didn't like routine work. Secondly, he didn't get to go to one of the Latin schools that the, you know, well-born in the Renaissance got to go to, or a university. And he had a bit of a chip on his shoulder. He said, you know, I'm a man without letters. I have to teach myself. And so you see a guy every day making a list of what he wants to learn and saying, I'm a disciple of experience. I can teach myself. He also had the good fortune to be born right when Gutenberg opens his print shop.
Mm-hmm.
So suddenly
he gets books. We're talking 1452, and suddenly there are commercial books, printed books available.
Exactly. 1452 is when Leonardo's born and when Gutenberg first starts selling books from his shop. And so you see a guy who is the beginning of what we would call modern times, the scientific revolution, the Enlightenment, because he doesn't take received wisdom from medieval scholastics or, you know, scholars. What he does is, let me test things. Let me see if what works.
He was worked on props as a theater producer. What else? Mm-hmm. How did he come into the fullness of this? How did he get the freedom and range?
Well, he was
to do
lucky when he was, you know, very young, 12, his father brings him to Florence and apprentices him to an art shop, you know, Verrocchio's mm-hmm. studio. Mm-hmm. And Verrocchio did all sorts of things. Mainly he made helmets and costumes for big pageants and performances. So some of the first drawings of Leonardo are, you know, of ornate helmets. He also, they did a lot of painting, a lot of sculpting. And it wasn't a day in which artists were very famous. You just worked at a workshop, and you turn these things out. But Leonardo, especially when Verrocchio's painting, say, the Baptism of Christ, Leonardo does the River Jordan and does the ripples around the ankles of Jesus and the cup. Or he does the angel in another of Verrocchio's paintings. And you almost see the other characters in the painting looking at this angel and saying, where did this angel come from?
Yes.
And one of the early tales about Leonardo is his teacher throwing down the brush in despair, saying, I'll never paint as well as Leonardo, and letting Leonardo from then on do all the paintings in the shop.
So there's the kind of studio work that he was doing. How did he materially reach out and gain the freedom to work and think and imagine more broadly?
Well, he does a lot of paintings on his own when he's a teenager in early 20s living in Florence. But he has a problem, which is if it's not perfect, he doesn't deliver it. He lets the perfect be the enemy of the good. And so you have wonderful half-finished paintings like the Adoration of the Magi that has, you know, beautiful reactions on every face, but it's so complicated, it gives it up. And so he leaves Florence and he writes the coolest job application letter in history because he wants to go to Milan.
Mm-hmm.
He's bringing musical instruments as a gift to the Duke of Milan because among the many things Leonardo did was he invented musical instruments. He invented sort of a violin-type lyre that looked like the shape of a horse. And so he goes to Milan and he writes an 11-paragraph letter seeking a job from the Duke. In the first 10 paragraphs, he talks about his talent as an engineer. He says, I can divert mm-hmm. rivers. I can build beautiful buildings. I can make weapons of war. I can make flying machines. Only in the 11th paragraph does he say, I can also paint.
Yes. Where did he get that? Who told him that? Was it self-generated? Did he have some kind of a great mentor or inspiration who, you know, touched his forehead?
Well, he did have the great teacher in Verrocchio, and we have to remember back then that people didn't make that much of a distinction between art in engineering then. For example, Brunelleschi, who does the dome of the wonderful cathedral in Florence, and Alberti. These are all right around the time of Leonardo, a little bit older than him. And he learns the math of perspective and the engineering arts and the design arts and beauty are all rolled into one when you're trying to put a dome on a cathedral, or in Leonardo's case, he helped put the copper ball on top of that dome. So I think he thought that engineering was just another way of doing a brushstroke to make something beautiful.
And there's so much beauty came out of that.
Well, you know, and that's what we have to learn today, as when you say people should be engineers, or people, maybe some people like art. We have to learn to blur the distinction, or actually make no distinction between, and that's what Steve Jobs did. He believed that engineering, beauty mattered. That when he did the iPod or the iPhone, he believed it wasn't just technical engineering, it was also making something beautiful. Whenever Steve Jobs launched a product, he would show us a slide that showed the intersection of liberal arts street and technology street, meaning that the arts and sciences should be connected. That's what we learned from Leonardo, is not to make that distinction between art and science.
Walter Isaacson's big new biography is Leonardo da Vinci. Simple as that. Behind us here, the sound of one of those instruments that Leonardo created. He called it a viola organista. Here a Polish pianist brought that to life. This is a Sławomir Zubrzycki. Played it back in 2013. Walter Isaacson, please stand by. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
Support for this podcast and the following message comes from ZipRecruiter, who understands when you run a business, you've got important decisions to make every day, like hiring. ZipRecruiter makes finding quality candidates simple. With one click at ZipRecruiter.com/OP, you can post your job to 100 leading job sites across the web and manage your candidates all in one place with ZipRecruiter's easy-to-use dashboard. Find out today why ZipRecruiter has been used by businesses of all sizes to hire. Try ZipRecruiter for free at ZipRecruiter.com/OP.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with popular historian extraordinaire Walter Isaacson about the latest great figure in his sights, Leonardo da Vinci, Renaissance man, maybe the most creative genius ever. That is Walter Isaacson's assertion about Leonardo da Vinci. That is the title of his new biography as well. He joins us today from New York. You can join us. What's your question for Walter Isaacson about Leonardo da Vinci, his life, his work, his mind? And what do you see shining through his paintings and drawings and dreams? What would Leonardo be up to now if he were alive today? Would he be a god of Silicon Valley or something else? Walter Isaacson, lots of callers for you. Roger in Hanover, New Hampshire. Roger, you're on with Walter.
It's a fascinating chance to mention what I've done, some research on the collaboration between Leonardo and Niccolo Machiavelli, when Machiavelli was sort of the Henry Kissinger of Florence. They worked on a project to change the course of the Arno River so that Florence could become a seaport.
I have a whole chapter on that. This is an amazing collaboration. They also collaborated with Cesar Borgia on some of the military activities. Leonardo drew maps. And you have a wonderful scene in this town of Imola in which Cesar Borgia, Machiavelli, and Leonardo spend an entire winter in this tiny town together. And then afterwards, as Roger just said, they decide to try to divert the course of the Arno River, both to make a seaport for Florence, but also to win a war against Pisa, because they figure if they can get the river away from Pisa, then Pisa will have to surrender.
Roger, what did you make of that collaboration and its fruit?
It's one of the first, if not the first, really major example try and conquer nature for the convenience of humans, which is the essence of modernity.
Walter, that's a pretty good sweeping observation. What do you say, Mr. Isaacson?
Well, that was why Leonardo loved engineering. And he especially loved the flow of water. I mentioned the River Jordan going past the ankles of Jesus in that first painting and how they ripple all the way to the last painting, which is, you know, the last culmination painting, really, the Mona Lisa, where the river comes down from the eons of the ages and seems to flow into the Mona Lisa's body. As Roger said, this notion of conquering nature and then connecting ourselves with nature was the essence of what Leonardo did. And certainly when he works with Machiavelli, I mean, just two amazing characters, they really do feel that engineering can conquer nature. I'd push back a little on the first time because you have ever since ancient times in Milan, Leonardo had studied it, the way they channel the water coming down from the mountains to make the canals of Milan, to spin the mills, to
or go to South Asia, Mohenjo-Daro. You've got major engineering projects.
And so water engineering was something from the ages, you know, since ancient times, had been one of the things they mastered in Milan. And when you read Leonardo's notebooks, he's always saying, get the master of the lock of the dam in this part of Milan to show you how the gates open and close with just, you know, one touch or whatever. So he is fascinated from ancient times by this engineering of water.
Put us, though, in the context of his times. We think of him as the maybe one of the ultimate Renaissance men.
He is the ultimate.
Is he... Did the Renaissance set the table for him? Did he make it what we think of it? How do you see him in relation to that large idea of the Renaissance?
I think the Renaissance sets the table for him in the sense that, let's just take Florence. You know, it's a town he's born into, and what you have is people working across disciplines suddenly. You have gold beaters working next to cloth merchants, to artists and architects and chemists, and they create all sorts of new products. You also have the printing press coming in. You also have a middle class, an upper middle class, and wealthy with the Medici that become patrons of the arts. You have the fall of Constantinople. So from the East, people are bringing back algebra, you know, from the Arab world. So all – and they're very tolerant. Leonardo is gay. He's illegitimate. He's left-handed.
He's vegetarian.
He dresses in purple. He's vegetarian. He's sort of, as Steve Jobs would say, one of the misfits, rebels, the round pegs and the square holes, except for Florence was like not a square hole for people like that. Florence – tolerated and even celebrated diversity. So I think that's why Florence becomes the cradle of the Renaissance, and that's why Leonardo becomes Leonardo.
Can you give us a sense of the sort of chronology? And I get that it's difficult because he would work on some projects for years, but when we think of his sketches, his mechanical drawings, his famous paintings, what's the order of these things? Is there a build that you see in his creative life?
Yeah, when he goes from Florence to Milan in around 1482, as I said, writing that letter, when he talks about his engineering skills and says, but I can also paint. That's when he starts doing first the pageants and the great plays in the court of Milan, and then builds flying machines, or tries to, and gliders that work, that he does a lot of that engineering. The first round of his anatomy drawings comes from dissecting people who had died in Milan at the hospital there. And he begins work on some of his greatest paintings. Of course, The Last Supper is done in Milan for the Duke of Milan. Then at around 1500, he moves back to Florence. And you see him starting in around 1503, some of the great paintings that were the culmination paintings, namely the Mona Lisa. But he was such a perfectionist that he starts the Mona Lisa around 1503. It's a portrait of the wife of a cloth merchant named Lisa, but he never delivers it to the cloth merchant. For the next 16 years until his deathbed, the Mona Lisa is by his side, and he's still working on it. So it's hard to pin down exactly what's the date of the Mona Lisa. Starts in 1503. He's still putting brushstrokes on it 15 years later.
Sometimes strapped to the side of a mule being carried around
We had to carry it across the mountains in Italy and then finally across the Alps to get it to France. But he doesn't let go of these pictures, which means that, he's a perfectionist. It also means there are a few cloth merchants, including Ginevra da Vinci's husband, Mona Lisa's husband, who are probably quite disappointed.
You have 7,000 of pages of notes that he left that you worked with. Does he write in there about what he was trying to achieve in the Mona Lisa, why he kept carrying it around and still working on it for 14 years?
Absolutely. He writes treatises that he never publishes, alas, but you can go visit his notebooks in various towns across Europe and the United States. And you see him writing a treatise on art, a treatise on optics, on light, on shadow, on mechanics. And he explains exactly what he's trying to do, and he connects it. For example, when he's doing the Mona Lisa, not only has he dissected faces and shown the muscles and nerves, as we talked about earlier, mm-hmm. he also has dissected the human eye and knows that if you're looking directly at something and it goes right to the center of your retina, you see the details, but at the corners of your retina, the sides of your retina, you see shadows. So he's perfecting that Mona Lisa smile by making the tiniest of details of the corner of the lips be downward turned slightly, but the shadows turn up. So it becomes an elusive smile. If you look directly at it, she may not look like she's smiling at you. But as your eyes wander to her cheek or to her chin or her forehead, all of a sudden the smile lights up. It flickers on and off. It's like an augmented reality. Mm-hmm. So you can see in the notebooks him figuring out certain really cool optics and science and then applying it to his engineering and to his art.
In the case of Mona Lisa, was he trying to achieve an anatomical accuracy, or did he write about this psychological effect that we feel when we observe her? Was that what he was – what was he pursuing?
He always wanted to attach or tie together inner emotions with outward manifestations, famously in the Last Supper, where every one of the apostles is gesturing, mm-hmm. showing emotions. But when he walked around Florence and then Milan carrying a notebook on his belt, he would always look at people's gestures and look at their faces and then try to figure out what their inner emotions were. And he even writes about how you can sort of assess inner emotions by outward gestures and motions. So the Mona Lisa is not just a portrait of a woman named Lisa. Otherwise, it would have been delivered at some point. He makes it into something universal. And it's almost, even though it's a still picture, a narrative drama where you can kind of feel the emotions behind that elusive smile. And every time you look at it, she seems to be thinking something different. So his paintings tend to be narrative dramas, most famously The Last Supper, where your mm-hmm. eye just almost sees a scene in motion after Jesus says, "One of you shall betray me." But the most amazing thing is to make a portrait like the Mona Lisa feel like it's a narrative in which the emotions change as you look at it.
Walter Isaacson's big new biography is Leonardo da Vinci. Mick is calling from Virginia Beach, Virginia. Mick, you're on with Walter. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom. I love the show. I'm a huge fan of Leonardo da Vinci.
Me too.
I was curious about a while back I saw a documentary where the claim was that a lot of his work could have been attributed to other people of the time in other locations. And I'm guessing that your guest there has done a lot of work in considering that. So I'm interested to hear his thoughts on
What are you suggesting there, Mick? That he copied or plagiarized?
Right. So the documentary and other research. And I'm like again a huge
yep.
fan of Leonardo da Vinci.
Yeah.
As is right as known.
Mm-hmm.
So, but one documentary I can recall was they described a number of his inventions, things that where he was famous for, flying machines, that sort of thing. That pointed towards other people about the same time, maybe a little earlier in history, they found, or they claimed to find, this.
Yeah, yeah. Mick, let us pick it up. Walter, what do you say? Walter Isaacson.
Mick, that's true of some of the engineering devices, not of his art, which was totally original. But engineering at the time, you know, he never made a claim that I've invented this totally new. He studied wonderful engineering books, and he lists in his notebook, he gives credit where it's due, exactly which books he's buying of great military engineers and others. And so we can go through his notebooks and say, well, he picked up the idea, say, for how you would do a certain type of hinge or a way to do a ladder that would go over a fortress wall. And he picked it up, but he added this from somebody else. Leonardo was very collaborative, too. Even Vitruvian Man, he did it with two of his friends. So I don't think Leonardo would even disagree with you. He would say, you know, look in my notebook. What I've done is I've looked at what other great engineers have done, and I've tried to make it more beautiful. I've tried to improve it. I would say his main originality comes with human anatomy. That's something where he did the dissections by himself. He discovers how the heart valve opens and closes. People thought it was the pressure of the blood going in and out of the aortic valve. But no, he knows it's the swirl of blood going from a larger chamber to a smaller one because he studied the swirls of rivers, as I said, from the baptism of Christ to the way Milan and the diverting of the Arno River. So his most original work, I think, was his anatomy and his art and his study of the flight of birds. But as Mick says, some of his military engineering, we see it in his notebooks. He's drawing from many others. And that's one essence of genius, is that it's a team sport. It's not something you do in the garage or garret all by yourself. And Leonardo knew that. He had so many friends, and he was always writing in his notebook, ask so-and-so how you would measure the size of the sun. You know, ask so-and-so how you would create ways to walk on ice. So he's always collaborating with the geniuses around him.
We're talking with Walter Isaacson. His new biography is Leonardo da Vinci. Jan, in Box Springs, Georgia. Thank you for calling, Jan. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I've always been told the story that Leonardo da Vinci, as a vegetarian, would go in the markets each morning and buy the birds and set them free. Mm-hmm. And which to me always seemed just the depth of his wisdom and awareness of the interconnectedness. And I was wondering, in your research, did you come across any story like that? I've always wondered if indeed it was true.
Well, Jan, you'll be happy to know it's definitely true. Contemporaries write about it, Vasari and others, that Leonardo would go to the marketplace, partly because he was a vegetarian, partly because he loved animals. And whether it was horses or birds, you know, he drew them, he sketched them, he knew every muscle and every nerve that made a wing of a bird work or a horse run. But yes, he would go to the marketplace, buy the caged birds, and set them free. He really did connect with nature that way.
I suppose some of them ended up dissected as well.
Well, he dissects horses that have died, and he measures it, and he does do the muscles of the breasts of birds. I don't know whether I doubt he would have bought a bird in a cage like that and then dissected it.
No need.
Because at least the contemporaries of him said he set him free.
Did he come close to flight, or it was too...
Yes, he made gliders that worked. But one of the things we learned from Leonardo is occasionally try things that are impossible, like building a perpetual motion machine or a machine in which a human can flap and fly. He tried it, he couldn't do it, and he learned why it was impossible, and that's a great lesson.
We're going to come back and look at his creativity, his personality, and some of the work that's still very much in motion today. Walter Isaacson's new biography is Leonardo da Vinci. Of course, Ned Kane Cole behind us here with Mona Lisa. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
Do you smile to tempt a lover, Mona Lisa? Or is this your way to hide a broken heart? Many dreams have been brought to your doorstep. They just lie there and they die there. Are you warm? Are you real? Mona Lisa, are just a cold and lonely, lovely work of art.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about Leonardo da Vinci. Biographer, historian Walter Isaacson has written up his life in full in a wonderful new biography. It is Leonardo da Vinci. You can link to it at our website to an excerpt, onpointradio.org, and you can join us today. Where would you like a Leonardo to put his or her energies today? How do you look at Leonardo? What do you think Leonardo da Vinci would be doing if he were alive right now? Here's Leonardo's Last Supper. Covers a wall in the Church of Santa Maria della Grazia in Milan. Tourists on YouTube here giving their reaction to that enormous, wondrous painting.
We are like in shock a little bit because Last Supper is one of the greatest artworks of Leonardo da Vinci.
What's so fascinating about it is that you can actually see the emotions on the people's faces in the painting.
Yes, you can. And Walter Isaacson goes deep on that painting and many other works. He's gone deeply into the notes, 7,000 plus pages of notes from Leonardo da Vinci that he has used as reference, and much more as well. Really just a remarkable book, a telling of this life. We've got lots of calls and comments for you, Walter. Sharon in Annapolis, Maryland. You're on with Walter Isaacson.
Hi, Mr. Isaacson. How are you?
Fine, thank you, Sharon.
Hi. I just wanted to thank you so much, you and NPR, for doing this on Leonardo da Vinci. Reason being, all we ever seem to have been taught is that he was an artist. And, of course, we all know the Mona Lisa. We don't know what she's about half the time or anything else, but we just know that's the guy that did it, and we see it hang in museums. I just went to a school function not long ago to my granddaughter, and one of the little boys there, his speech was on Leonardo da Vinci, and I found it really disappointing. Not that the little guy didn't try to do well, but all he talked about was the artistry, and that was it. Da Vinci is so diverse. His brain was so diverse. I mean, he's the epitome of a genius on so many levels.
Sharon, let us pick it up there, because you go to a point that Walter has made and a lot of people have responded to. You say, Walter, you give the superlative here, maybe the most creative genius of all time. That's a large statement. Now, you're a big biographer, so maybe you're entitled, but justify, sir. And thank you, Sharon.
It's partly because of what Sharon said, which is there are a lot of geniuses in a specific field, like Mozart in music or Euler in math. But as Sharon said, here was somebody who tried to know everything about everything that could be known about the universe and saw the patterns across disciplines. So what makes him the most creative of the geniuses, I mean, he's not necessarily a greater genius than, say, a Newton or an Einstein, but he's more creative because he's applying a pattern he sees in one place, such as the way water swirls around the ankle in a painting, to something, say, in anatomy, such as how a swirl of liquid would close a heart valve. And to me, an essence of creativity, as Sharon just said, is not just being an artist, but realizing that beauty matters in everything and connecting art to engineering, to anatomy, to geology, to figuring out, you know, how fossils work and to why the sky is blue, and mainly doing it out of pure curiosity. I mean, he studies why the sky is blue, but not simply because he's an artist. He studies it because he wants to know. And that curiosity about everything gives him, I think, a feel for nature's beauty and nature's patterns, for the infinite works of nature. And that, to me, is what defines creativity, not just being a genius.
What was his conclusion about why the sky is blue, and was he right?
He was right, and one of the cool things is that not only does he ask it in his notebook, when I was writing about Einstein, Einstein asks it in his notebook. Even Ben Franklin thinks about that. And you and I, Tom, if I may speak for you, we probably see a blue sky, you know, almost every day. We don't pause in our tracks and say, why is it blue? Now, it's blue because water vapor scatters light waves, and the lower end of the spectrum is scattered differently. Mm-hmm. But Leonardo tested that, not only with a vaporizing machine and shining light through it, but he said, let me do distilled water and non-distilled water to see if it was the particles that do it. And he comes up with the right answer. And years later, of course, we have Lord Rayleigh does it. But then Einstein comes up with the formula exactly of how an electromagnetic wave would curve. So to me, the people who ask the childlike questions, those questions that we outgrow when we outgrow our wonder years and quit asking ourselves or our parents, why is the sky blue? Those are the Leonardos and those are the Einsteins.
Scott writes to us and asks if you could talk about the relationship between Leonardo da Vinci and the church of this time, the Renaissance period.
Yes. Unlike Michelangelo, who has lived around the same time, who was involved with the agony and ecstasy of being deeply religious, Leonardo was at times heretical because he would use his scientific studies to question everything. All received wisdom, including biblical reason. Mm-hmm. For example, he lives near Florence. He loves the way the fossils come in layers. And he spends a lot of time looking. In fact, he's the first to discover what we call trace fossils, which aren't fossils of animals but of the traces they left in the mud. Mm-hmm. So he realizes, wow, they must have been living when they made, you know, when they became fossilized like this. And from that, he discovers or writes about that the biblical account of the flood, the deluge, cannot be right because it happens over centuries, over thousands of years, the layering of sediments. Likewise, he studies a fetus in the womb and questions the issues about a fetus and when the soul arrives there. So some of the people at the time said he's a bit heretical. Of course, he, you know, does do great religious art, including the Last Supper and the Virgin of the Rocks, which is scientifically beautiful with the layers of sediment, but also the religious connotations of Virgin of the Rocks is awesome to behold. So I don't think he was conventionally religious because he was willing to question things, but he also had a deep spirituality reflected in everything from Vitruvian Man, which is the proportions of a church, the proportions of the universe, and the proportions of man, to some of his greatest paintings.
Did he feel conflict with the church? Or, I mean, this was a time of great, in some respects, freeing. I mean he didn't run into the kind of trouble that Galileo did, I guess. This is the birth of humanism in this time.
Yeah, we have the great birth of humanism in Florence. So no, he doesn't particularly run into trouble, except in the 1490s when Savonarola, a friar, deeply religious, populist friar, starts persecuting, becomes the ruler of Florence, persecuting homosexuality and sodomy and other things. Fortunately for Leonardo, that was the decade he was in Milan. But you have a short period in Florence where there, and we have this in history often, a backlash against tolerance. And you have a few years until they get rid of Savonarola in which they have the bonfire of the vanities and they're burning books.
Out with the tyrant. Jess in Portland, Maine. Jess, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call, Tom, Mr. Isaacson. You know, I was, something struck me as you were talking about Leonardo and, you know, Tom introduced you as kind of a connoisseur of geniuses, I guess. You know, historically different, what what some would call diagnostic groups and what some would call, you know, just people who have a little different wiring, people on the autism spectrum or people with dyslexia, ADHD, you know, what have you. People sort of like to claim different geniuses into their neurological fold. You know, everyone thinks
one of us.
Oh, sorry, go ahead.
Just that people like to say he was one of us or she was one of us. What's your question here, Jess?
Yes, absolutely. I guess, you know, with Leonardo da Vinci, it's kind of a twofold question. First of all, did you see any, to your mind, any evidence that, you know, the red wire and the blue wire went to different places in his brain, you know, diagnosis or no? You know, did he kind of come across as this, that, or the other thing? And I guess my other question is, did you see any evidence in your reading of different groups kind of trying to lay claim to him?
Walter, I
yes, yes, it's true. I think of most people I've written about, whether it's Einstein or Leonardo, you know, different people with different ways of learning or different neurological makeups try to say, oh, he's ADHD or he's on the autism spectrum or whatever it may be. I think we biographers have to be careful not to psychoanalyze or look at people, you know, and try to just pigeonhole them, because in some ways that makes them less available to us if we just try to pigeonhole them. But certainly Leonardo went through bouts of depression. That's all in those notebook pages, you know, I got to read. He was often distracted. Sometimes he would be deeply, deeply focused and for days on end would try to solve a mathematical problem like the old problem of squaring the circle. And at other times, he would just put something aside and get distracted and not finish things. I think it's kind of good that he wasn't born today when everybody would have quickly diagnosed him and put him on some pharmaceutical regime to try to cure him of this, that, and the other thing. I think it was good that he was left to wrestle with both his demons and his angels and his dragons and everything else being wired the way he was.
Walter, a question online here about his painting Salvator Mundi, Savior of the World. And our listener writes on Twitter, says, Leonardo Salvator Mundi resembles the Mona Lisa and looks androgynous to me. What's your opinion?
Well, first let me tell people who haven't heard about it that Salvador Mundi was just authenticated as a true Leonardo in the past 5 to 10 years. And it's going on sale in 3 weeks. It'll be the only Leonardo painting in private hands, depending on who buys it.
A painting once and bought for $60 and it's expected to fetch around?
$125 million, give or take a buck or two.
Describe the painting.
And it's Jesus in a very, very mysterious sort of smile, giving a blessing, and in his right hand he's holding a crystal orb which represents the earth. Mm-hmm. It's called Salvador Mundi because it's the savior of the world. Mm-hmm. And it has very distinctive Leonardo touches, such as the slightly blurry lines of the face, because he didn't believe in sharp lines. But the blessing hand is a little bit sharper because he knew that that would make it look closer to you.
Yes.
Likewise, the crystal orb, he knows that it's supposed to deflect and, you know, distort Jesus' robes, but he makes it so that it doesn't, as if it's a miracle. And this painting, which, as I said, through technical reasons and connoisseurship, has been pretty much authenticated as being by the hand of Leonardo, bought for very few dollars, you know, a decade or two ago, now expected to sell at Christie's for more than $125 million. I think that the question that, you know, was asked, the androgyny.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, the Mona Lisa, and to me, one of my favorite paintings, it's in the Louvre, St. John the Baptist.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, Salvador Mundi. And even in The Last Supper, John, as we know from the Dan Brown Da Vinci Code novel, very androgynous, and Dan Brown claims it's Mary Magdalene, which I don't think it is.
Mm-hmm.
But Leonardo did blur the distinction between the sexes.
What do you make of that? Is it a nod to his own sexuality? Is it something about the way he saw the world?
I think it's the way he saw the world in terms of beauty. The very first angel he paints in one of his teacher, Verracchio's paintings, is just absolutely gorgeous.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, some art critics refer to it as a she, even though it's not. It's a male angel. We see that even in Virgin of the Rocks. Uriel, the angel, is very androgynous. And we know Leonardo had two boyfriends throughout his life, Salai and Melzi, and they're both very, very pretty. So, yes, it's part of Leonardo's idea of beauty, but it's, you know, you look at the paintings and they really are beautiful.
No question about it. And as you say, sharp lines, that's not where he was drawn.
He didn't have sharp lines between reality and imagination, or between objects and their background, or even between, you know, the androgynous characters he painted. He loved, and this is one of the great lessons from him, to be open to mystery.
And the lesson ultimately that you take about creativity from this genius's life?
The number one lesson is to be curious about everything, to be curious not just because it'll be useful, but curiosity for its own sake. Over and over again, you'll look at the pages of his notebooks, and he's asking himself questions and pausing to observe how a spot of light causes a bit of luster on a curl of hair, or exactly how water flows into the bowl and how it swirls and what the bubbles do. And at one point, my favorite line, after a whole list of about 15 things he wanted to learn, he writes, "Describe the tongue of the woodpecker." Now, who would wake up one morning and say, "I want to know what a tongue of a woodpecker looks like"? How would you even know? But that's Leonardo. He wanted to know, and he wanted to know because he was curious about everything.
Mm. Walter Isaacson, we're always happy when you sally forth and go deep, and this is just terrific, a wonderful read, an amazing life and work, and we're very grateful to you for spending some time with us to talk about it today. Thank you so much.
Tom, it is always great being with you. Thanks.
Walter Isaacson, author of Steve Jobs, Einstein, His Life and Universe, Benjamin Franklin, and American Life, and now Leonardo da Vinci. Listeners, you can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm on Twitter at Tom Ashbrook, NPR. Thanks for being with us today. This is On Point.